December 17, 2020. 1. As an honor roll senior at Houghton High, Barbara Robinson is pretty much free to go as she lists during her free period, which runs from 9 to 9:50. When the bell rings releasing her from her early English writers class, she wanders down to the art room, which is deserted at this hour. She takes her phone from her hip pocket and calls Jerome. From the sound of his voice, she's pretty sure she woke him up. Oh, for the life of a writer, she thinks. Barbara doesn't waste time. Where is she this morning, Jay?
Don't know, he says. I dumped the tracker.
True? True. Well, okay. Can I go back to sleep now? No, she says. Barbara has been up since 6:45 and misery loves company. Time to get up and grab the world by the balls.
Mouth, sister, he says, and boom, he's gone.
Barbara stands by some kid's really bad watercolor of the lake, staring at her phone and frowning. Jerome is probably right. Holly went off to meet some guy she met on that dating website. Not to fuck him, that's not Holly, but to make a human connection? To reach out, as her therapist has no doubt been telling her she must do? That Barbara can believe. Portland has got to be at least 500 miles from the site of that bombing she was so interested in, after all, maybe more. Put yourself in her shoes, Barbara tells herself. Wouldn't you want your privacy? And wouldn't you be mad if you ever found out that your friends, your so-called friends, were spying on you? Holly wasn't going to find out. But did that change the basic equation? No. Was she still worried? A little worried? Yes, but some worries had to be lived with. She slips her phone back into her pocket and decides to go down to the music room and practice her guitar until 20th century American history. She's trying to learn the old Wilson Pickett soul shouter in the midnight hour. The bar chords and the bridge are a bitch, but she's getting there. On her way out, she almost runs into Justin Freelander, a junior who's a founding member of Houghton's Geek Squad and who has, according to rumor, a major crush on her. She smiles at him, and Justin immediately turns that alarming shade of red of which only white boys are capable. Rumor confirmed. It suddenly occurs to Barbara that this might be fate. She says, "Hey, Justin, I wonder if you could help me with something," and takes her phone out of her pocket. 2. While Justin Freelander is examining Barbara's phone, which is still, oh God, warm from being in her back pocket, Holly is landing at Pittsburgh International. 10 minutes later, she's in line at the Avis counter. Uber would be cheaper, but having her own ride is wiser. A year or so after Pete Huntley came on board at Finders Keepers, the two of them took a driving course meant to teach surveillance and evasion. A refresher for him, new for her. She doesn't expect to need the former today, but recourse to the latter isn't out of the question. She is meeting a dangerous man. She parks in the lot of an airport hotel to kill some time. Early to my own funeral, she thinks again. She calls her mother. Charlotte doesn't answer, which doesn't mean she's not there. Direct-to-voicemail is one of her old punishing techniques for when she feels her daughter has stepped out of line. Holly next calls Pete, who asks again what she's doing and when she'll be back. Thinking of Dan Bell and his terribly gay grandson, she tells him she's visiting friends in New England and will be in the office bright and early on Monday morning.
"You better be," Pete says. "You have a depot on Tuesday, and the office Christmas party is on Wednesday. I plan to kiss you under the mistletoe."
"Oof," Holly says, but she's smiling. She arrives at the Monroeville Mall at 11:15 and makes herself sit in the car for another 15 minutes, alternately punching her Fitbit, pulse running just over 100, and praying for strength and calm. Also, to be convincing. At 11:30, she enters the mall and takes a slow stroll past some of the shops. Jimmy Jazz, Clutch, Boobaloo strollers, looking in the windows, not to scope out the merchandise, but to catch a reflected glimpse of Chet Ondowski, should he be watching her. And it will be Chet. His other self, the one she thinks of as George, is the most wanted man in America just now. Holly supposes he might have a third template, but she thinks it unlikely. He's got a pig self and a fox self. Why would he think he'd need more? At 12:10, she gets in line at Starbucks for a cup of coffee, then queues at Sparrow for a slice of pizza she doesn't want. She unzips her jacket so the pink turtleneck shows, then finds an unoccupied table in the food court. Although it's lunchtime, there are quite a few of those, more than she expected, and that makes her uneasy. The mall itself is low on foot traffic, especially for the Christmas shopping season. Seems to have fallen on hard times. Everybody buys from Amazon these days. Noon comes. A young man wearing cool sunglasses and a quilted jacket, a couple of ski lift tags dangle jauntily from the zipper, slows, as if he means to chat her up, then moves on. Holly is relieved. She has little in the way of brush-off skills, never having had much reason to develop them. At 12:05, she starts to think Ondowski isn't coming. Then at 7:07, a man speaks from behind her, and in the warm, "We're all pals here" voice of a TV regular, "Hello, Holly." She jumps and almost spills her coffee. It's the young man with the cool sunglasses. At first she thinks this is a third template after all, but when he takes them off, she sees it's Ondowski, all right. His face is slightly more angular. The creases around his mouth are gone, and his eyes are closer together. Not a good look for TV, but it's him, and not young at all. She can't see any lines and wrinkles on his face, but she senses them and thinks there may be a lot. The masquerade is a good one, but up this close, it's like Botox or plastic surgery. "Because I know," she thinks, "I know what he is." "I thought it would be best if I looked just a bit different," he says. "When I'm Chet, I tend to get recognized. TV journalists aren't exactly Tom Cruise, but..." A modest shrug finishes the thought. With his sunglasses off, she sees something else. His eyes have a shimmery quality, as if they're underwater, or not there at all. And isn't there something similar going on with his mouth? Holly thinks of how the picture looks when you're at a 3D movie and take off the glasses. "You see it, don't you?" The voice is still warm and friendly. It goes well with the small smile dimpling the corners of his mouth. "Most people don't. It's the transition. It will be gone in 5 minutes, 10 at most. I had to come here directly from the station. You've caused me some problems, Holly." She realizes she can hear the small pause when he occasionally puts his tongue to the roof of his mouth to stop the lisp. "That makes me think of an old country song by Travis Tritt." She sounds calm enough, but she can't take her eyes from his, where the sclera shimmers into the iris, and the iris shimmers into the pupil. For the time being, they're countries with unstable borders. "It's called Here's a Quarter, Call Someone Who Cares." He smiles, the lips seeming to spread too far, and then snap. The minute shivers in his eyes remain, but his mouth is solid again. He looks to her left, where an old gent in a park and a tweed cap is reading a magazine. "Is that your friend? Or is it the woman over there who's been looking into the window of Forever 21 a suspiciously long time?" Maybe it's both of them. Holly says. Now that the confrontation is here, she feels okay. Or almost. Those eyes are disturbing and disorienting. Looking into them too long will give her a headache, but he would take looking away as a sign of weakness, and it would be. You know me, but all I have is your given name. What's the rest of it? Gibney. Holly Gibney. And what is it you want, Holly Gibney? $300,000. Blackmail, he says, and gives his head a small shake as if he's disappointed in her. Do you know what blackmail is, Holly? She remembers one of the late Bill Hodges' old maxims. There were many. You don't answer a perp's questions. The perp answers yours. So she simply sits and waits with her small hands folded beside her unwanted slice of pizza. Blackmail is rent, he says. Not even rent to buy. A scam Chet on guard knows well. Let's suppose I had $300,000, which I don't. There's a big difference between what a TV reporter makes and what a TV actor makes. But let's suppose you've been around for a long, long time, Holly says, and putting money away all the while. Let's suppose that's how you finance your what exactly? Your lifestyle and your background, bogus IDs and all. He smiles. It's charming. All right, Holly Gibney, let's suppose that the central problem for me remains. Blackmail is rent. When the 300K is gone, you'll come back with your photoshopped pictures and your electronically altered voice prints and threaten me with exposure all over again. Holly is ready for this. She didn't need Bill to tell her that the best confabulation is the one containing the most truth. No, she says. 300,000 is all I want because it's all I need. She pauses. Although there is one other thing. And what would that be? The pleasant TV-trained tones have become condescending. Let's stick with the money for now. Recently, my Uncle Henry was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. He's in an elder care facility that specializes in housing and treating people like him. It's very expensive, but that's really beside the point because he hates it there. He's very upset, and my mother wants to bring him back home. Only she can't care for him. She thinks she can, but she can't. She's getting old. She has medical problems of her own, and the house would have to be retrofitted for an invalid. She thinks of Dan Bell. Ramps, a stair chair, and a bed hoist to start with, but those things are minor. I'd want to hire round-the-clock care for him, including an RN in the daytime. Such expensive plans, Holly Gibney. You must love the old dear. Very much. I do, Holly says. It's the truth, even though Uncle Henry is a pain in the ass. Love is a gift. Love is also a chain with a manacle at each end. His general health is bad. Congestive heart failure is the main physical problem. Again, she has Dan Bell to draw on. He's in a wheelchair and on oxygen. He might live another 2 years. It's possible he could live three. I've run the numbers, and $300,000 would keep him for five. And if he lives six, you'd come back. She finds herself thinking of young Frank Peterson, murdered by that other outsider in Flint City, murdered in the most gruesome and painful way. She's suddenly furious with Ondowski, him with his trained TV reporter's voice and his condescending smile. He's a piece of poop, except poop is too mild. She leans forward, fixing her gaze on those eyes, which have finally, thankfully, begun to settle. "Listen to me, you child-murdering piece of shit. I don't want to ask you for more money. I don't even want to ask you for this money. I never want to see you again. I can't believe I'm actually planning to let you go. And if you don't wipe that fracking smile off your face, I just may change my mind."
Andowski recoils as if slapped, and the smile does indeed disappear. Has he ever been spoken to like this? Maybe, but not for a long time. He's a respected TV journalist. When he's Chet on guard, cheating contractors and pill mill proprietors quail at his approach. His eyebrows, they are very thin, she notices, as if hair really doesn't want to grow there, draw together.
"You can't. Shut up and listen to me," Holly says in a low, intense voice. She leans even further forward, not just invading his space, but threatening it. This is a Holly her mother has never seen, although Charlotte's seen enough in these last 5 or 6 years to consider her daughter a stranger, maybe even a changeling. "Are you listening? You better be, or I'll call this off and walk away. I won't get $300,000 from Inside View, but I'll bet I can get $50,000, and that's a start."
"I'm listening." Listening has one of those pauses in the middle. This one is longer. Because he's upset, Holly surmises.
Good. Upset is just how she wants him. $300,000. Cash. 50s and 100s. Put it in a box like the one you took to the MacReady school. Although you don't have to bother with the Christmas stickers and the fake uniform. Bring it to my place of business on Saturday evening at 6 p.m. That gives you the rest of today and all of tomorrow to put the cash together. Be on time, not late like you were today. If you're late, your goose is cooked. You want to remember how close I am to pulling the plug on this? You make me sick.
Also the truth, and she guesses that if she pushed the button on the side of her Fitbit now, her pulse would be up around 170.
Just for the sake of discussion, what is your place of business? And what business do you do there?
Answering those questions may be signing her death warrant if she fracks up. Holly knows this, but it's too late to turn back now.
The Frederick Building, she names the city. On Saturday at 6, and just before Christmas, we'll have the whole place to ourselves. 5th floor, finders keepers.
What is finders keepers exactly? Some kind of collection agency? He wrinkles his nose as if at a bad smell.
We do a few collections, Holly admits. Mostly other things. We're an investigative agency.
Oh, my God. Are you an actual private eye?
He has regained enough of his sang-froid to sarcastically pat his chest in the vicinity of his heart.
If he has one, Holly bets it's black.
Holly has no intention of chasing that. 6 o'clock, 5th floor, 300,000, 50s and 100s in a box. Use the side door. Phone me when you arrive, and I'll give you the lock code by text.
Is there a camera? The question doesn't surprise Holly in the least. He's a TV reporter. Unlike the outsider who killed Frank Peterson, cameras are his life.
There is, but it's broken. From the ice storm early this month. It hasn't been fixed yet.
She can see he doesn't believe that, but it happens to be the truth. Al Jordan, the building super, is a lazybones who should have been fired, in Holly's humble opinion and Pete's, long since.
It's not just the side entrance camera. If not for Jerome, people with offices on the 8th floor would still be trudging up the stairs all the way to the top of the building. There's a metal detector inside the door, and that does work. It's built into the walls. There's no way to dodge around it. If you come early, I'll know. If you try to bring a gun, I'll know that. Following me?
Yes.
No smile now. She doesn't have to be telepathic to know he's thinking she's a meddlesome, troublesome cunt. That's fine with Holly. It beats being a wimp scared of her own shadow. Take the elevator. I'll hear it. It's noisy. When it opens, I'll be waiting for you in the hall. We'll make the exchange there. Everything's on a flash drive.
And how will the exchange work?
Never mind for now. Just believe it's going to work, so we both walk away.
And I'm supposed to trust you on that.
Another question she has no intention of answering. Let's talk about the other thing I need from you. This is where she either seals the deal or doesn't.
What is it?
Now he sounds almost sullen. The old man I told you about, the one who spotted you.
How? How did he do that?
Never mind that either. The thing is, he's been keeping an eye on you for years. Decades. She watches his face closely and is satisfied with what she sees there. Shock. He left you alone because he thought you were a hyena. Or a crow. Something that lives on roadkill. Not nice, but part of the, I don't know, the ecosystem, I guess. But then you decided that wasn't enough, didn't you? You thought, why wait around for some tragedy, some massacre, when I can make my own? DIY, right? Nothing from Undowski. He simply watches her, and even though his eyes are now still, they're awful. It's her death warrant, all right. And she's not just signing it. She's writing it herself. Have you done it before?
A long pause. Just when Holly has decided he isn't going to answer, which will be an answer, he does. No. But I was hungry.
And he smiles. It makes her feel like screaming.
You look frightened, Holly Gibney.
No use lying about that. I am. But I'm also determined. She leans forward into his space again. It's one of the hardest things she's ever done. So here's the other thing. I'll give you a pass this time, but never do it again. If you do, I'll know.
And then what? You'll come after me.
It's Holly's turn not to speak.
How many copies of this material do you actually have, Holly Gibney?
Only one, Holly says. Everything's on the flash drive, and I'll give it to you on Saturday evening. But, she points a finger at him and is pleased to see it doesn't tremble. I know your face. I know both your faces. I know your voice, things about it you may not know yourself. She's thinking of the pauses to defeat the lisp. Go your way. Eat your rotten food. But if I even suspect you've caused another tragedy, another MacReady school, then yes, I'll come after you. I'll hunt you down. I'll blow up your life.
Undowski looks around at the nearly empty food court. Both the old man in the tweed cap and the woman who was staring at the mannequins in the window of Forever 21 are gone. There are people queuing at the fast food franchises, but their backs are turned. I don't think anyone's watching us, Holly Gibney. I think you're on your own. I think I could reach across this table and snap your scrawny neck and be gone before anyone realized what happened. I'm very fast.
If he sees she's terrified, and she is, because she knows he's both desperate and furious to find himself in this position, he may do it. Probably will do it. So once more she forces herself to lean forward. You might not be fast enough to keep me from screaming your name, which I believe everyone in the Pittsburgh metro area knows. I'm quite speedy myself. Would you like to take the chance?
There's a moment when he's either deciding or pretending to. Then he says,
Saturday evening at 6, Frederick Building, 5th floor. I bring the money. You give me the thumb drive. That's the deal. That's the deal. And you'll keep your silence. Unless there's another MacReady school, yes. If there is, I'll start shouting what I know from the rooftops. And I'll go on shouting until someone believes me. All right. He sticks out his hand, but doesn't seem surprised when Holly declines to shake it or even touch it. He gets to his feet and smiles again. It's the one that makes her feel like screaming. The school was a mistake. I see that now. He puts on his sunglasses and is halfway across the food court almost before Holly has time to register his departure. He wasn't lying about being fast. Maybe she could have avoided his hands if he'd reached across the small table, but she has her doubts. One quick twist and he'd have been gone, leaving a woman with her chin on her chest as if she's dozed off over her little lunch. But it's only a temporary reprieve. All right, he said. Just that. No hesitation, no asking for assurances, no questions about how she could be sure some future explosion resulting in multiple casualties, a bus, a train, a shopping center like this one, wasn't his doing. The school was a mistake, he said. I see that now. But she was the mistake, one that needed to be corrected. He doesn't mean to pay me. He means to kill me, she thinks, as she takes her untouched slice and her Starbucks cup to the nearest trash receptacle. Then she almost laughs, like I didn't know that all along. 3. The mall parking lot is cold and windswept. At the height of the holiday buying season, it should be full, but it's only at half capacity, if that. Holly is exquisitely aware that she's on her own. There are large empty spaces where the wind can really do its work, numbing her face and sometimes almost making her stagger, but there are also clusters of parked cars. Ondowski could be hiding behind any one of them, ready to leap out, I'm very fast, and grab her. She runs the last 10 steps to the rental, and once she's inside, she pushes the button that locks all the doors. She sits there for half a minute, getting herself under control. She doesn't check her Fitbit because she wouldn't like its news. Holly drives away from the mall, checking her rearview mirror every few seconds. She doesn't believe she's being followed, but goes into evasive driving mode anyway. Better safe than sorry. She knows Ondowski might expect her to take a commuter flight back home, so she plans to spend the night in Pittsburgh and take an Amtrak tomorrow. She pulls into a Holiday Inn Express and turns on her phone to check for messages before going inside. There's one from her mother. Holly, I don't know where you are, but Uncle Henry's had an accident at that damn Rolling Hills place. He may have a broken arm. Please call me. Please. Holly hears both her mother's distress and the old accusation. I needed you, and you've disappointed me again. The pad of her finger comes within a millimeter of returning her mother's call. Old habits are hard to break, and default positions are hard to change. The flush of shame is already heating her forehead, cheeks, and throat, and the words she'll say when her mother answers are already in her mouth. I'm sorry. And why not? All her life she's been apologizing to her mother, who always forgives her with that expression on her face that says, Oh, Holly, you never change. You are such a reliable disappointer. Because Charlotte Gibney also has her default positions. This time, Holly stays her finger, thinking, why exactly should she be sorry? What would she be apologizing for? That she wasn't there to save poor addled Uncle Henry from breaking his arm? That she didn't answer the phone the minute, the very second that her mother called, as if Charlotte's life is the most important life, the real life, and Holly's only her mother's cast shadow?
Facing Ondowski was hard. Refusing to immediately answer her mother's cri de coeur is just as hard, maybe even harder. But she does. Although it makes her feel like a bad daughter, she calls the Rolling Hills Elder Care Center instead. She identifies herself and asks for Mrs. Braddock. She's put on hold and suffers the little drummer boy until Mrs. Braddock comes on. Holly thinks it's music to commit suicide by. "Miss Gibney," Mrs. Braddock says, "is it too early to wish you happy holidays?" "Not at all. Thank you, Mrs. Braddock. My mother called and said my uncle has had an accident." Mrs. Braddock laughs. "Saved one, more like it. I called your mother and told her. Your uncle's mental state may have deteriorated somewhat, but there's certainly nothing wrong with his reflexes." "What happened?" "The first day or so, he didn't want to come out of his room," Mrs. Braddock says. "But that's not unusual. Our new arrivals are always disoriented and often in distress, sometimes in great distress, in which case we give them something to calm them down a bit. Your uncle didn't need that, and yesterday he came out all on his own and sat in the day room. He even helped Mrs. Hatfield with her jigsaw puzzle. He watched that crazy judge show he likes." "John Law," Holly thinks and smiles. She's hardly aware that she is constantly checking her mirrors to make sure Chet Ondowski, "I'm very fast," isn't lurking. "Afternoon snacks."
"Beg pardon?" Holly says. "I lost you for a second."
"I said that when the show was over, some of them headed into the dining hall where there are afternoon snacks. Your uncle was walking with Mrs. Hatfield, who is 82 and rather unsteady. Anyway, she tripped and might have taken quite a bad fall. Only Henry grabbed her. Sarah Whitlock," she's one of our nurse's aides, "said he reacted very quickly. Like lightning," were her actual words. "Anyway, he took her weight and fell against the wall where there's a fire extinguisher. State law, you know. He has quite the bruise, but he may have saved Mrs. Hatfield from a concussion, or even worse. She's very frail."
"Uncle Henry didn't break anything when he hit the fire extinguisher?"
Mrs. Braddock laughs again.
"Oh, heavens, no." "That's good. Tell my uncle he's my hero."
"I will. And once again, happy holidays."
"I'm Holly, and therefore must be jolly," she says,
a creaky witticism she's been using at this time of year since she was 12. She ends the call on Mrs. Braddock's laughter, then looks at the dull brick side of the Holiday Inn Express for a while, arms crossed over her scant bosom, brow furrowed in thought. She comes to a decision and calls her mother.
"Oh, Holly, at last, where have you been? Isn't it bad enough I have my brother to worry about without having to worry about you, too?"
The urge to say, "I'm sorry," once more arises, and she reminds herself again that she has nothing to apologize for.
"I'm fine, Mom. I'm in Pittsburgh."
"Pittsburgh?"
"But I can be home in a little over 2 hours if the traffic isn't bad and Avis will let me return their car down there. Is my room made up?"
"It's always made up," Charlotte says.
"Of course it is," Holly thinks, "because eventually I'll come to my senses and return to it."
"Great," Holly says.
"I'll be there in time for supper. We can watch some television and go see Uncle Henry tomorrow. If that would be..."
"I'm so worried about him,"
Charlotte cries.
"But not worried enough to jump in your car and go there," Holly thinks, "because Mrs. Braddock called you and you know this isn't about your brother. It's about bringing your daughter to heal. It's too late for that, and I think in your heart you know it, but you won't stop trying. That's also a default position."
"I'm sure he's all right, Mom." "They say he is, but of course they would, wouldn't they? Those places always have their guard up in case of lawsuits."
"We'll visit and see for ourselves," Holly says. "Right?"
"Oh, I guess so." A pause. "I suppose you'll leave after we visit him, won't you? Go back to that city."
Subtext, that Sodom, that Gomorrah, that pit of sin and degradation.
"I'll be having Christmas by myself while you have Christmas dinner with your friends."
"Including that young black man who looks like he might take drugs?"
"Mom,"
sometimes Holly feels like screaming,
"the Robinsons invited me. weeks ago, right after Thanksgiving, I told you, and you said it was fine.
What Charlotte had actually said was, "Well, I suppose if you feel you have to."
That was when I thought Henry would still be here.
Well, how about if I stay Friday night, too? She can do that for her mother, and she can also do it for herself. She's sure Andowski is perfectly capable of finding out where she lives in the city and showing up there 24 hours early and with murder on his mind.
We could have Christmas early. That would be wonderful, Charlotte says, brightening up. I can roast a chicken. And asparagus. You love asparagus.
Holly hates asparagus, but telling her mother that would be useless.
Sounds good, Mom.
4. Holly seals the deal with Avis at an additional fee, of course, and gets on the road, stopping only once to gas up, grab a filet-o-fish at Mickey D's, and make a couple of calls. Yes, she tells Jerome and Pete, she's finished her personal business. She'll be spending most of the weekend with her mother and visiting her uncle in his new residence, back at work on Monday.
Barbara's digging the movies, Jerome tells her, but she says they're totally vanilla. She says that watching them, you'd think there was no such thing as black people.
Tell her to put it in her report, Holly says. I'll give her Shaft when I get a chance. Now, I have to get back on the road. The traffic is very heavy, although I don't know where they're all going. I went to a mall, and it was half empty.
They're visiting relatives just like you, Jerome says. Relatives are the one thing Amazon can't deliver.
As she merges back onto I-76, it occurs to Holly that her mother will undoubtedly have Christmas presents for her, and she has nothing for Charlotte. She can already see her mother's martyred look when she turns up empty-handed.
So she stops at the next shopping center, even though it means she won't be at Casa Gibney until after dark. She hates driving at night, and buys her mother some slippers and a nice bathrobe. She makes sure to keep the sales slip for when Charlotte tells her that Holly has bought the wrong sizes.
Once she's on the road again and safe inside her rental car, Holly draws in a deep breath and lets it out in a scream. It helps.
5. Charlotte embraces her daughter on the doorstep, then draws her inside. Holly knows what comes next.
You've lost weight.
Actually, I'm just the same, Holly says, and her mother gives her the look, the one that says, once an anorexic, always an anorexic.
Dinner is takeout from the Italian place down the road, and as they eat, Charlotte talks about how hard things have been without Henry. It's as if her brother has been gone 5 years instead of 5 days, and not to a nearby elder care facility, but to spend his old age doing stupid stuff far away, running a bicycle shop in Australia, or painting sunsets in the tropic isles. She does not ask Holly about her life, her work, or what she was doing in Pittsburgh. By 9 o'clock, when Holly can reasonably plead tiredness and go to bed, she started to feel as if she's growing younger and smaller, diminishing to the sad, lonely, and anorexic girl, yes, it was true, at least during her nightmare freshman year of high school, when she was known as Jibba Jibba Gibba Gibba, who lived in this house. Her bedroom is just the same, with the dark pink walls that always made her think of half-cooked flesh. Her stuffed animals are still on the shelf above her narrow bed, with Mr. Rabbit Trick holding pride of place. Mr. Rabbit Trick's ears are ragged because she used to nibble on them when she couldn't sleep. The Sylvia Plath poster still hangs on the wall above the desk where Holly wrote her bad poetry and sometimes imagined committing suicide in the manner of her idol. As she undresses, she thinks she might have done it, or at least tried it, if their oven had been gas instead of electric. It would be easy, much too easy, to think this childhood room has been waiting for her like a monster in a horror story. She slept here several times in the sane, relatively sane, years of her adulthood, and it has never eaten her. Her mother has never eaten her either. There is a monster, but it's not in this room or in this house.
Holly knows she would do well to remember that, and to remember who she is. Not the child who nibbled Mr. Rabbit Trick's ears. Not the adolescent who threw up her breakfast most days before school. She is the woman who, along with Bill and Jerome, saved those children at the Midwest Culture and Arts Complex. She is the woman who survived Brady Hartsfield, the one who faced another monster in a Texas cave. The girl who hid in this room and never wanted to come out is gone. She kneels, says her nightly prayer, and gets into bed.
December 18, 2020. 1. Charlotte, Holly, and Uncle Henry sit in one corner of the Rolling Hills common room, which has been decorated for the season. There are ribbons of tinsel and sweet-smelling swags of fur that almost overcome the more permanent aroma of pea and bleach. There's a tree hung with lights and candy canes. Christmas music spills down from the speakers. Tired tunes Holly could live happily without for the rest of her life. The residents don't seem exactly bursting with holiday spirit. Most of them are watching an infomercial for something called the Ab Lounge, featuring a hot chick in an orange leotard. A few others are turned away from the tube, some silent, some holding conversations with each other, some talking to themselves. A wisp of an old lady in a green house coat is bent over a huge jigsaw puzzle.
"That's Mrs. Hatfield," Uncle Henry says. "I don't recall her first name."
"Mrs. Braddock says you saved her from a bad fall," Holly says.
"No, that was Julia," Uncle Henry says. "Back at the old swimming hole."
He laughs as people do when they are remembering days of yore. Charlotte rolls her eyes.
"I was 16, and I believe Julia was."
He trails off.
"Let me see your arm," Charlotte commands. Uncle Henry cocks his head.
"My arm? Why?"
"Just let me see it." She seizes it and pushes up his shirt sleeve. There's a good size but not especially remarkable bruise there. To Holly, it looks like a tattoo gone bad.
"If this is how they take care of people, we should sue them instead of paying them," Charlotte says.
"Sue who?" Uncle Henry says, then with a laugh. "Horton hears a who. The kids love that one."
Charlotte stands. "I'm going to get a coffee. Maybe one of those little tart things as well, Holly." Holly shakes her head.
"You're not eating again," Charlotte says, and leaves before Holly can reply. Henry watches her go.
"She never lets up, does she?"
This time it's Holly who laughs. She can't help it. "No, she doesn't."
"No, never does. You're not Janie."
"No," and waits.
"You're..."
She can almost hear rusty gears turning.
"Holly."
"That's right." She pats his hand.
"I'd like to go back to my room, but I don't remember where it is."
"I know the way," Holly says. "I'll take you." They walk slowly down the hall together.
"Who was Julia?" Holly asks.
"Pretty as the dawn,"
Uncle Henry says. Holly decides that's answer enough. Certainly a better line of poetry than she ever wrote. In his room, she tries to guide him to the chair by the window, but he disengages his hand from hers and goes to the bed, where he sits with his hands clasped between his thighs. He looks like an elderly child.
"I think I'll lie down, sweetie. I'm tired. Charlotte makes me tired."
"Sometimes she makes me tired, too," Holly says. In the old days, she never would have admitted this to Uncle Henry, who was all too often her mother's co-conspirator. But this is a different man, in some ways a much gentler man. Besides, in 5 minutes, he'll forget she said it. In 10, he'll forget she was here. She bends to kiss his cheek, then stops with her lips just above his skin when he says,
"What's wrong? Why are you afraid?"
"I'm not."
"Oh, you are. You are."
"All right," she says. "I am. I'm afraid."
Such a relief to admit it, to say it out loud.
Your mother, my sister, it's on the tip of my tongue.
Charlotte.
Yes. Charlie's a coward. Always was, even when we were children. Wouldn't go in the water at the place. I can't remember. You were a coward, but you grew out of it.
She looks at him amazed, speechless.
Grew out of it,
he repeats, then pushes off his slippers and swings his feet onto the bed.
I'm going to have a nap, Janie. This isn't such a bad place, but I wish I had that thing you twist.
He closes his eyes. Holly goes to the door with her head down. There are tears on her face. She takes a tissue from her pocket and wipes them away. She doesn't want Charlotte to see them.
I wish you could remember saving that woman from falling down, she says. The nurse's aide said you move like lightning.
But Uncle Henry doesn't hear. Uncle Henry has gone to sleep.
2. From Holly Gibney's report to Detective Ralph Anderson.
I expected to finish this last night in a Pennsylvania motel, but a family matter came up and I drove to my mother's house instead. Being here is difficult. There are memories, many of them not so good. I will stay tonight, though. It's better that I do. Mom is out now, buying things for an early Christmas dinner that will probably not be tasty. Cooking has never been one of her talents. I hope to finish my business with Chet Ondowski, the thing that calls itself that anyway, tomorrow evening. I'm scared. No sense lying about that. He promised to never do anything again like the MacReady School. Promised it right away, without even thinking it over, and I don't believe it. Bill wouldn't, and I'm sure you wouldn't either. He has a taste for it now. He may also have a taste for being the heroic rescuer, although he must know that calling attention to himself is a bad idea. I phoned Dan Bell and told him I intended to put an end to Ondowski. I felt that as ex-police himself, he would understand and approve. He did, but told me to be careful. I will try to do that, but I'd be lying if I didn't say that I have a very bad feeling about this. I also called my friend Barbara Robinson and told her I will be staying over at my mother's on Saturday night. I need to make sure that she and her brother Jerome think I won't be in the city tomorrow. No matter what happens to me, I need to know they will not be at risk. Ondowski is worried about what I may do with the information I've gotten, but he's also confident. He'll kill me if he can. I know this. What he doesn't know is that I have been in these situations before and won't underestimate him. Bill Hodges, my friend and sometime partner, remembered me in his will. There was the death benefit from his insurance policy, but there were other keepsakes that mean even more to me. One was his service weapon, a .38 Smith & Wesson military and police revolver. Bill told me that most city police now carry the Glock 22, which holds 15 rounds instead of 6, but that he himself was old school and proud of it. I don't like guns. Hate them, in fact. But I will use Bill's tomorrow, and I won't hesitate. There will be no discussion. I had one conversation with Ondowski, and that was enough. I will shoot him in the chest, and not just because the best shot is always the center mass shot, a thing I learned in the shooting class I took 2 years ago. The real reason is... Pause. You remember what happened in the cave when I hit the thing we found there in the head? Of course you do. We dream about it, and we'll never forget it. I believe the force, the physical force that animates these things is a kind of alien brain that has replaced the human brain which might have existed before being taken over. I don't know where it originated, and I don't care. Shooting this thing in the chest may not kill it. In fact, Ralph, I'm sort of counting on that. I believe there's another way to get rid of it for good. You see, there's been a glitch. My mother just drove in. I'll try to finish this later today or tomorrow.
3. Charlotte won't let Holly help with the cooking. Every time her daughter comes into the kitchen, Charlotte shoos her out. It makes for a long day, but the dinner hour finally arrives. Charlotte has put on the green dress she wears every Christmas, proud of the fact that she can still get into it. Her Christmas pin, Holly and Holly Berries, is in its accustomed place over her left breast.
"An authentic Christmas dinner, just like in the old days," she exclaims as she leads Holly into the dining room by the elbow, like a prisoner being led into an interrogation room, Holly thinks. "I've made all your favorites."
They sit across from each other. Charlotte has lit her aromatherapy candles, which give off a lemongrass scent that makes Holly want to sneeze. They toast each other with thimble glasses of Mogan David wine, an authentic ugh, if ever there was one, and wish each other a Merry Christmas. Then comes a salad already dressed with the snot-like ranch dressing Holly hates. Charlotte thinks she loves it. And the dry-as-papyrus turkey, which can only be swallowed with lots of gravy to grease its passage. The mashed potatoes are lumpy. The overcooked asparagus is as limp and hateful as ever. Only the carrot cake, store-bought, is tasty. Holly eats everything on her plate and compliments her mother, who beams. After the dishes are done, Holly dries, as always. Her mother claims she never gets all the smudge off the pots. They repair to the living room, where Charlotte hunts out the DVD of It's a Wonderful Life. How many Christmas seasons have they watched it? A dozen, at least, and probably more. Uncle Henry used to be able to quote every line. Maybe, Holly thinks, he still can. She's Googled Alzheimer's and found out there's no way of telling what areas of the mind remain bright as the circuits shut down, one by one. Before the film begins, Charlotte hands Holly a Santa hat, and with great ceremony.
"You always wear it when we watch this," she says. "Ever since you were a little girl, it's a tradition."
Holly has been a movie buff all her life and has found things to enjoy even in films the critics have roasted. She believes, for example, that Stallone's Cobra is woefully underestimated. But It's a Wonderful Life has always made her uneasy. She can relate to George Bailey at the beginning of the film, but by the end, he strikes her as someone with a serious bipolar condition who's arrived at the manic part of his cycle. She has even wondered if, after the movie ends, he creeps out of bed and murders his whole family. They watch the movie, Charlotte in her Christmas dress and Holly in her Santa hat. Holly thinks, "I am moving somewhere else now. I feel myself going. It's a sad place full of shadows. This is the place where you know death is very close." On the screen, Janie Bailey says, "Please God, something's the matter with Daddy." That night, when she sleeps, Holly dreams that Chet Ondowski comes out of the Frederick Building elevator with his jacket torn at the sleeve and the pocket. His hands are smeared with brick dust and blood. His eyes are shimmering. And when his lips spread in a wide grin, squirming red bugs spill from his mouth and stream down his chin.